Hello, welcome to episode 124 of Decentralized Revolution. It's the Mises Caucus podcast. I'm Aaron. Mike isn't here this week. He will be back next week. But I have, as always, Brandy Bishop, who, how are you? You look, your setup does look cool. It looks cooler every time. There's something different. I don't know, but it looks great. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. It's kind of all kinds of technical stuff right before we got on. Every week, I think I have it set up just right, and every week something is not quite right, but we're all set now. We have a couple of guests. We have two and possibly a third guest coming in, and they are successful local candidates who have gotten endorsements and other support from the Mises Caucus, and we're going to introduce them here in a second so they can tell us, you know, how they got involved in the horrible business of politics that we all hate, but that we're all doing because we want to change things for the better. And so they will be with us in just a moment. Our other guest host for tonight is Amy Lepore. Amy, how are you?
I'm excellent, Aaron. It's good to be here with you and Brandy.
Yeah, you didn't get the memo. Like you're supposed to have like a dark, you know, mellow mood lighting type thing, and here you all, bright and shiny.
We're just in my office. There's not a whole lot. Like I said to Brandy earlier, she's got a killer background. There's nothing interesting going on in here.
Yeah. I know who you are, but tell everyone else who probably they know your work, but they may not know your name with the Mises Caucus. So tell everybody what you do for us.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. So I am the candidate support coordinator for the Mises Caucus, and as such, I have the good fortune of working with all of our excellent candidates who are running for local office and maintaining a relationship with some of the folks you're going to meet tonight. So our people who have won and are serving currently in local office, and yeah, I'm enjoying doing that.
And that, you know, is a main sort of plank of our, you know, what we do with the Mises Caucus. And we kind of codified that with the Project Decentralized Revolution document strategy that came out, I think, back in December. Right around the same time, I think it was, we launched Run as Libertarian. And you've kind of been, you know, when people go there and enter in things, it comes to you. So tell everybody what Run as Libertarian is and, you know, who should consider signing up over there.
Yeah, a good question. So we are using runaslibertarian.com as kind of a method of entry. If you are a person who is considering running for office or a person who is considering volunteering or managing a campaign. So if you are any of those things or if you are a person who's just kind of wants to stick their toe in, learn a little bit more about running for office, gain some valuable skills, you can register there. When you do, you receive all of our training notifications and access to our training library. I think we've got 13 or 14 sessions now. And so in doing so, you also gain access to resources that we provide, conversations, not just with me, even though I do try to help our candidates, but we can link potential candidates with mentors, some of whom you'll meet tonight. So we do have our elected officials serving in that capacity. And so anyone who's interested in either running or helping on a campaign is able to go there, access training, and access guidance as well.
Yeah. And I think that the part about if you want to be a campaign manager or a big time campaign volunteer, especially maybe if you're a local Mises Caucus organizer, if you're an LP party official at the state or county level, and you want some campaign training, please go to runaslibertarian.com as well. You don't have to be the person to, you know, put your name on the ballot, but those people need people around them. And, you know, potentially someone could do this training, and then you could then help recruit somebody who maybe already does have a name in the community, or try to flip someone who's, you know, if it's a nonpartisan, whereas most local places are, somebody who maybe isn't a libertarian yet or who's disaffected with whatever team they've been on before. If you're well-trained and have these resources and know how to run a campaign, you know, then maybe you can help them as well. So one last quick thing. You kind of know a lot about the Defend the Guard stuff as far as what's going on. We, if you don't know yet, if you're plugged in with the Mises Caucus at all, you should know that the Defend the Guard is the movement. The guys over at bringourtroopshome.us, and it is state legislation that would prevent the governor of that state from deploying his state's National Guard troops overseas to any situation where there's not a declared war. And so that's kind of fighting the empire and doing the decentralization stuff. And it's at defendtheguard.com/phonebank. Is that it, Amy?
It is defendtheguard.us/phonebank.
I've got it in here somewhere.
Yep. defendtheguard.us/phonebank.
Yeah. And so tell them when they go there, what will they get back and what will they be asked to do, Amy?
So we have been supporting Bring the Troops Home in their effort to recruit phone banking volunteers. If you go to this site and you sign up, you may not get something immediately, but your name and your phone number and your email will go into a repository where when it's time to make phone calls, like we were doing last week to folks in New Hampshire, when it's time to make phone calls, you will get information from Diego. He works for Bring the Troops Home. He's an incredible supporter of the Defend the Guard legislation and works all over the country to build up a volunteer force who can help with this.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's they're having a little, I think they've flipped a couple legislators in New Hampshire recently. And I think something's coming up in a few weeks over there. So but it's not just New Hampshire. These things kind of come up at different unexpected times sometimes. We've helped them with phone banking in the past. And so I think this thing is really gaining momentum. So let's go ahead and bring our guests on. And thanks, guys, for hanging out in the wings there. Bill Schultz, city councilman in Crescent Springs, Kentucky. And James Cook, you're the mayor of Rock Hall, Maryland, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. I'll let you go first and just tell us a little bit about Rock Hall, how you got involved, why you wanted help from the Mises Caucus, and, you know, when you got in as mayor and how things are going.
Sure thing. So Rock Hall is a small town on Maryland's eastern shore. It's a waterfront town. It's got a long history of, you know, like, you know, industry on the water, you know, fishing, crabbing, you know, but, it, you know, it's a pretty vibrant tourist industry and that kind of thing. I got involved roughly 3 years ago. I was elected to city council. And really, you know, so what I do professionally is engineering, construction management, and I teach engineering and that kind of thing. So as with a lot of small towns that are very old, I mean, my town was founded in 1707, so it's been around for a long time. The infrastructure is very, very old, and that's kind of one of the things that I fixed professionally. So really, it wasn't even anything specifically political that I got involved in. I just really felt that my skill set was able to help my community, and, you know, so I ran for council. You know, there was five other people in the election, and I came out on top. And so for the next 2 years of my 4-year term, you know, I really just, you know, just worked hard on a lot of different things. And, you know, I guess that received recognition and decided to run for mayor. Former mayor, they were, you know, coming up on their off year election, you know, so it was after my 2 years and my 4-year term, their 4-year term was up. And so I decided to run, you know, because I think there was a lot of things that, you know, I learned in my first 2 years on council that wasn't necessarily directly related to the infrastructure, which was my original passion. But there's a lot of other things that I felt that could use a little bit of leadership on. And, you know, I ended up coming out on top on that election as well. And, you know, the Mises Caucus was really, really helpful as far as, you know, helping with, you know, ideas and campaign ideas and getting the word out, door knocking. It's just a really great community that was really supportive. And, you know, I always prided myself on, you know, knocking on every door, and I couldn't have done that by myself, but the ability to knock on every single door within the town, I think really was a way to kind of set me apart from everybody else because I actually put the effort in. You know, I'm less than half the age of anybody else that was running and didn't have as much name recognition, and I was kind of brand new on council. So I was facing kind of an uphill battle, but I think just the work you put in, the work and people they tend to recognize that kind of thing. And that's how I got involved. That was my original inspiration. There's been a lot of stories and what I would say success stories and other challenges and things that I've learned and, you know, had to come to terms with along the way. But, you know, overall, I think it's been a pretty wonderful experience. And, you know, I think especially on the local levels where we have the ability to make the most impact, you know, everybody that you interact with is your neighbor. You all are facing very, very similar problems and struggles. And, you know, chances are you probably, you know that person or know their family or know something about maybe where they work or something like that. And so it's very, very personal. Every single interaction, you know, you get to see some of the real world impact that you have by just listening to people. That's been, you know, one of the things that I've tried to emulate and really kind of live by is I tell everyone, I will listen. I don't know everything, but I'm here to listen. And if I can help and come up with a solution, I'll be happy to do that. And I think that's gone a long way too, just listening to people and coming up with common sense things. And my favorite part about all of that, you know, is, you know, especially on the local stage, is you don't necessarily have to take a partisan stand one way or another. It's much more focused on common sense stuff. Is that, you know, I've got super progressives that I know are like Democratic, progressive, you know, socialist caucus type people. And then, you know, your Trump MAGA crowd and then just anybody in between are all, you know, turned out to be supporters. And I just think that's kind of cool. It's just, you know, unifying people, taking out some of that political language and just talking about what's in front of people and being able to execute, you know, solutions that work for everyone. So that particular thing has been very fulfilling to me. And I think that's the beauty of local politics.
Yeah. The beauty of local politics. I didn't think I'd hear that phrase today. I used to be a newspaper reporter covering local politics. And somebody like you guys who have the patience to do that, I really appreciate you guys. So, Bill, tell us about your story, just like James filled us in on his.
Yeah, and thanks a lot, Aaron, Brandy, and Amy for having me. So I am a newly minted councilman in Crescent Springs, Kentucky. I was elected in November. My term began in January. Crescent Springs is a suburb of Cincinnati, Ohio, just about 5 miles from downtown Cincinnati. So right smack in the suburbs. Thomas Massey is our representative, and a lot of the people locally align politically like he does. I would say, though, and I think this is something I heard from Jeff Deist a long time ago, the people who actually wind up running for office tend to be a little more left than the actual constituents themselves. And yes, I will not be talking about the beauty of local politics. It can be quite a drag. But no, my story is, you know, I was a libertarian voter from a young age, or from the first moment I could vote. My mom always gives me a hard time. We went to the first polls together. She heard me ask for a pen because I needed to do a write-in, a protest vote at the time. And so I was voted libertarian, never was involved in the Libertarian Party or the Libertarian Party Mises Caucus. Didn't even cross my mind to look for or try to get involved in that sort of thing. But I, you know, 2020 was my breaking point first of all, just, you know, some horrible presidential candidates, but also, of course, all of the COVID regime, all of the lockdown, all of that. So that inspired me to really get involved with the LP, helped re-spin up a county affiliate. And it's interesting because I feel like what I believe is personally the most impactful way aligns so perfectly with the decentralized revolution and runaslibertarian.com. Nothing against the, you know, running the local party affiliate, and nothing against being an activist, nothing against, of course, podcasting. There are roles to play. But for me, after about 2 years of doing all the activism, the local stuff, the trying to do things with the LP of Ohio as well, I said, it's time for me to run for office. And so with Amy's, with a lot of Amy individually support, but really the Mises Caucus as a whole, and the Libertarian National Committee as well, a little bit, I was able to, run in November of 2022 for city council. I was the highest vote receiver of 6 spots. So if and when the mayor's out, I get to run the meeting, and I'll do my best Karen Ann Harlow's impression with Robert's Rules of Order. But no, it's been an interesting ride. I felt like the first 6 months or so has been really about getting my feet under me, getting understanding of where to push, where not to push. And we're getting to a point right now, and when I say right now, I mean as of about 2 hours ago, where I'm starting to be the one pushing back on a lot of things in this city. And specifically, the mayor and several council members announced today they want to support a property tax increase. And obviously, I'm not going to support that. And I told everybody that in person and otherwise. So But no, it's going to be a real opportunity to make an enormous difference in the life of or in the lives of each of my neighbors, each of our constituents, everybody in Crescent Springs. So, and I think a lot of what James said is totally accurate too. So much at the local level really is common sense. And I think with the type of people that have been in a lot of these positions before, they haven't ever asked the basic questions. And you ask the basic questions, and all of a sudden you get a very clear answer, and you're able to push back on some things that would have just easily glided through before. So yeah, I'm excited to really, now that I really feel like I have my feet under me, to really get going and insert some of that radical stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd be curious to see what Brandy thinks of this. I don't know. You're somewhat involved with the LP in Massachusetts, and mm-hmm. How was local politics working for you guys there? And based on what you've seen with the party there in Massachusetts, what would you want to learn and ask James and Bill about based on their experience?
Well, I mean, the LP party situation in Mass is pretty messy, but the one thing that I wanted to ask both of you guys was, what's something that you wish you knew before running for local office? Like, what's something that you had no idea, like, you went in and you were like, I wish this advice was given to me. James, you want to go first?
Well, I mean, one of the big things that I still struggle with is how little control or say that you have, and how much it's less of, you know, just kind of speaking the truth, but realizing that, you know, county level and state level and federal level really override and take a lot of your ability to kind of make decisions for your community away from the place that is close to your community. And that's been the most frustrating piece. I mean, I was, you know, semi-aware kind of like from a consultant, like engineering consultant, so helping municipalities kind of navigate some of that red tape. But when you're on the other side of that and you're not, you know, in the private sector trying to help, and you're, you know, in the public sector, so to speak, and trying to get something done, the amount of red tape that is in your way is, it's infuriating at times. And it really limits, you know, we say common sense, right? But if you can't even enact common sense, like silly things like the main road through the middle of town is actually technically a state road. So I can't change anything about it. I have to ask permission to do things like that. And that may seem like a silly thing, but those are some of the things that really matter on a local level. And so, you know, it goes from having to navigate the county. So you almost are forced to play the game. You're almost forced to make connections and, you know, make friends, or at least be visible to the people that are higher up on the food chain than you in order for you to best represent your community. So that is a struggle. And that's something I didn't quite realize to what extent those types of things play a role in the day-to-day business on a local level, but it is a huge factor. And it's kind of, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So is it more the state or the federal, or are you saying it's both that causes the kind of like barriers?
I would say, you know, mostly it's state, to be honest with you. There are some federal things like, in Maryland, it's like MDE, which is the environmental regulations. For example, we've got a business owner who's got a restaurant. It's a great restaurant. It's very, very close to the water. But within 1,000 feet of the water, I'm going to get into some technical stuff, but it's called the Maryland Critical Areas. And Maryland Critical Areas, the town has very, very little jurisdiction over what happens there. It's all state level. So in Maryland Critical Areas, the state has to review any kind of increase in what they call impervious area, which is parking lots, buildings, or anything. They're the ones to approve it. I have no say. And so there's a very successful restaurant. He's brought a lot of, you know, employment to the town, and it's a great attraction, but it's in the Maryland critical areas. And, you know, he's getting a lot of people that want parking, and he wanted to add a piece of parking to his property. And so he came to the town, and, you know, we did all the necessary, you know, hey, here's all the things you need to know about. The thing that I'm going to let you know that is that you need to get approval from Maryland critical areas, because I don't have any control over that. And he's been fighting that for over a year just to get something as simple as parking. And so to have that kind of, you know, technically it's the town's jurisdiction, but there are some things that are out of our control those types of things are very, very frustrating. And, you know, that is, you know, MBE works very, very close with EPA, which is on the federal level. And so they kind of have these recommended guidelines. And then, you know, the states kind of just enact the guidelines on a state level, which is why there's not, it's pretty uniform, right? The federal government has its recommendations. The states just, we just enact it. And then the local control is taken from local to then state. And so it's that type of thing. It's just one step further removed. Whether it's a state or federal, they tend to work together on those types of things.
I'll agree 100% with James. I have the exact same experience. And one thing, I'll add a few things to it. Number one is once you're actually in there in a role, you're able to really find some of the most ridiculous state laws that are out there. And like as an example, and I'm still investigating this one, but you know, my understanding is that my city is not allowed to set our tax rates in a way that would project lower revenues in the prior year, that we have to keep it high. We have to be between 0% and 4% increase. It's out of control. And so you find so much more, but I'll also put a more positive spin on the same point as James. And this would be apply to your question as well, Brandy, about what I wish I would have known before is you'd be shocked how easy it is to make your voice heard and gain some influence. Like the number of people that show up to our meetings is not a huge number. And if you show up and have a few, you know, a few points you want to make, the council, as long as you don't do it in a particularly obnoxious way, the council and the mayor are going to listen to you. Now, this often can be used in a really negative way. You know, for example, like one guy showed up one time to a meeting and said, hey, can you connect the sidewalk from my road to this other road? You know, I don't know. Let's call it 150 yards of sidewalk. And I think he came just once and he basically complained once. And now the city's going to spend $45,000 to connect this sidewalk, which, you know, I'm not saying that the sidewalk's the worst idea, but I'm just saying it wasn't like this guy had to run this big, long, month-long campaign of showing up and complaining and emailing. He just came once and he got what he wanted. Same thing James alluded to earlier. Before I got elected, I kept in close touch with my state rep. We would just email her about, you know, various things I saw on the state docket and ask her how she was going to vote and give her my opinion. And to her credit, she's super responsive. When I got elected into office, exactly like James said, our main road through town is part of it state road. Then it moves to county. Then it moves to city, even though it's all in our city. And, you know, so the city and the county would do our snow removal and the state wouldn't. They were lowest on their list. I was able to reach out to my rep and say, you need to get us moved from level 4 to level 2 or whatever. And we got it done. And the mayor's like, how in the world did you do that? It's like, I don't know, 15 emails over the course of a year to my rep, like before I got elected. It's not like it's the most difficult thing. So you know, you can make an impact. And again, like I alluded to earlier, like if you don't make that impact, somebody much, much worse than you is going to fill that gap. So it's important, even before you're elected, or if you're not going to run for office, show up to a few meetings, send a few emails, and you'd be surprised how much good you can do. Or maybe a better way to put it is how much bad you can stop. But one of the two.
Bill and James are excellent examples of what we expect out of our candidates. They are both professional, articulate, and well-respected in their communities. And because of that, they do both get to wield some influence. You know, James, as you said, was on council before he was mayor. And, you know, by my own study of James, is very well-respected in his community. And that respect is starting to grow because, James, I see you are kind of have some membership in the Maryland Municipal League, and you're out and likely making some of these connections, maybe even with state agencies, right? So you can kind of work within the confines of the boundaries they've put up. Bill is much the same. Bill was engaged in his community prior to running for office, which is absolutely something that we encourage, and well-known and well-respected, and so now wields that influence as a city council member. So these are, you know, two incredible examples of what is possible if you take local politics seriously. Pretty incredible.
Yeah, and just to touch on that a little bit, you know, one of the cool things you mentioned as part of Maryland Municipal League, which is basically it's kind of a lobbying organization for all of the towns and cities in the entire state. And, you know, what they say has a lot of influence over state legislatures. And that was one of the reasons I got involved is because, you know, it's the board of directors is a small group and then the association is huge, right? So if you're on the board of directors, you can kind of change and influence the topics of discussion. Like you set what agenda you're rolling with in, for the next 12 months. And, you know, just as a minor example to that, you know, some of the shift has gone from maybe like DEI type conversations to now this year we're working on, you know, limiting or any tax revenue generated locally stays there instead of going to the state. Like working on those types of initiatives. Like that's a real conversation we're having, is like, why is everything going to the state and to the federal level instead of it should be staying as local as possible? Because, you know, you, it goes to the bureaucracy. And by the time it gets back to you, you're applying to get your own money back. And it's just, so it's like that change in conversation really struck me just by one or two people mentioning this type of thing. Now it's starting to spread throughout the entire state. You know, and other things like double taxation. That's another one where the county, you know, takes a lot more from the town residents than they need to and providing, you know, duplicate services, and the same thing for the state. And now we're actually introducing legislation both on the county level and on the state level to stop that. So the county can't overtax the towns and cities and really have to stay within the confines of what they can get, you know, out in the county. So I know it's kind of minor and, you know, splitting hairs in a way to a lot of people that really want radical change. But I will tell you that is pretty radical when you're talking about making a shift in momentum. So the fact that we're having these types of conversations is just, it blows me away. And I'm very, very happy. I've only been on that board for 2 years. And I'm already on, you know, I'm the president of ESAM, which is the entire Eastern Shore, all the towns on the Eastern Shore. I'm the president of that organization now. And I'm the chairman of the Council of Governments for my entire county. So having, just by getting elected 3 years ago as council, I've been able to, one, meet people, make influence, and then start to change these types of conversations we have locally, countywide, you know, regionally, and then across the entire state. Just shifting the things we talk about. And that shifts the nature of the type of legislation and conversations that we have. So you can make a, you know, a lot of inroads and influence just by getting out there, talking to people, you know, dropping a couple of, you know, bombs of wisdom in the ears of some people that are around. And if it makes sense, you can really make a difference both locally and across your state. So
there's a lot in there that was pretty interesting. And it kind of leads into a question I had of, you know, you just mentioned that on certain particular issues, you bring it up and then now other towns are talking about it. As libertarians, I think sometimes we suffer under the misconception that, okay, well, if we have the best ideas and if we just explain it to people, then they will, you know, bow to our superior moral judgment and logic and we'll win the argument. And of course, it doesn't usually happen that way in real life. But as someone who is showing up to these things and has a completely different take than, and this is for both of you, on just an interpersonal level, when you bring up what might be a radical issue for someone who's been on city council for 20 years or who's, you know, they've always done it this way, why would we do it another way? How do you, on that interpersonal level, both like in a public meeting and then, you know, in outside the, you know, where the cameras aren't on or whatever, what works, what doesn't work as far as connecting with other people who also have a part in these decisions?
I would say one important aspect to that is being transparent and being clear in your communication with people. I think that people really get their egos, more than ideologies, people get their egos all upset if you drop a bomb on them they're not expecting. So, you know, you have to navigate around open records laws and open meetings acts and all that kind of stuff. But I'm pretty good about when something comes up, I'm going to let people know, hey, here's how I feel about this and here's why, whether that's in a meeting, whether it's outside of a meeting, anything like that. The other thing I'd say, I mean, Aaron, you're exactly right. You know, this is true with any institution, particularly government, but the whole, oh, we've always done it that way is a limiting factor. But I think a way to make a positive difference kind of separate from that is to bring new ideas. You know, one basic idea, I didn't share my professional background, but I'm a CPA accountant by background, but I've sort of shifted careers. I own a senior care business, but leveraging my financial background, you know, I went to our city clerk and I said, we need to create a list of not even all assets. It's all future obligations, everything that this city is ever going to be financially responsible for. So that obviously includes equipment and buildings and any land the city owns, and also roads and the things we're responsible for, maintenance, the park, all of that. And you know, she and our public works director were like, oh, that's a great idea. And out of that, you know, we got this list now of, hey, here's everything the city is ever going to be financially responsible for. And so we can actually seriously project, okay, what does this city need to run in terms of funding and all that? And also make a roadmap of, all right, which of these things are going to need to be replaced in the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. And so, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, institutional inertia and the addiction to the past and the way we always did things is true. But you can make a difference by bringing new ideas, new perspectives that no one even takes offense to. Everyone's like, oh, that's a great idea. And then it gains you a little bit of credibility later when you want to make a more radical change.
Yeah, James, talk about your, you know, the interpersonal side of things.
Yeah, I take a strategy of trying to build the relationship. I feel like if you come across, there's a lot of, so if you're like me and you're watching, you know, come from the whole Ron Paul revolution, and I don't, you know, particularly enjoy either one of the major parties on a federal level, and it causes, you know, federal politics kind of just frustrates me to a lot. So it creates a lot of angst there. And I think for a lot of people, including a lot of local politicians, they kind of subscribe to one or other, you know, ideology. And some of that frustration from like the federal or state level kind of bleeds through when they're talking about issues. And it can get kind of hostile in a way, like, well, I don't think that's right. You're just trying to do this or something like that, which is kind of insulting. So you don't really get anywhere. It's almost kind of just like a show of force. And, you know, Bill, as you mentioned, kind of an ego fest. So something that I've tried to do is just kind of say, hey, I need, you know, you guys are the experts. Like, we're here to kind of, you know, represent the people. Here's a problem that, you know, I've noticed. Let's throw around some ideas to try to fix it. And that kind of, it brings them in. And so everyone's on the same side, and it kind of creates this collaboration, this energy of where people are looking to try to solve the problem together. And there's no finger pointing. It's like, hey guys, I have a problem. I need your help with it. Or we have a problem. Can we work on this together? And if you kind of set the tone like that, people's defenses aren't up. So even people that are on, you know, opposite sides of the aisle or whatever you want to call it, tend to try to work collaboratively. It's kind of amazing. So I've got a pretty split council. You know, I know we're not technically partisan, but you know, I know who's what and who gets along and all that stuff. But when you present an issue like that and you say, hey council, let's talk about this, let's throw around some ideas about it, it's kind of amazing how the defenses come down and people just work together. So that's my kind of approach, is more of a, you know, less my ideas but more our ideas, but kind of leading the conversation with information and just kind of open dialogue and trying to get the input of the citizens. Like, one of the things I did was start a communications board. We hadn't had one before, just to kind of make sure that all the information that we have is clear, transparent, so we can get feedback from the community. And so that, you know, council can talk freely about, you know, a lot of the information we're gleaning from the community. And, you know, that just works wonders. We've had a pretty unanimous thing. There's only been one vote that wasn't unanimous, which I'm shocked by. One before, it was split, you know, 4-1, 3-2 all the time. We've only had one that was split, and it was a fair split. You know, I'm like, hey, either way, I can't judge it for voting one way or another. But it's almost kind of, in my mind, it should be the mayor, but it can be anybody on mayor and council, to kind of set the tone of how we're interacting with each other. And that can really take the ego out of it and really make the representatives of the people actually work for the people.
I'd like to add one more thing if I could, Aaron. The angle of the Libertarian Party aspect of this too. So, you know, I personally had virtually zero interest in running for office. I really did it because I wanted one more Libertarian to be elected. But what's interesting, and it's hard for those of us that probably spend too much time on Twitter getting involved in all the caucus wars and the internal infighting and the internal fighting. Most non-libertarians don't even know what's happening. They have no idea. They barely know what a libertarian is. And I say that in a good way from the standpoint of local politics, because it's important to me that I'm shining a light on the LP. So I tell people I'm a member of the Libertarian Party, and that's my background. But my other council members and the mayor, they don't view that as, oh, this guy's got a radical ideology. They view it as, you know, sort of like, oh, he's the swing vote. You know, he's not going to be the team red or team blue. I can get him to my side. And so it's a good place to be. And people want to have you on their side. They want you, you know, for the things they care about to be a part of their vote. And so you can really leverage that. Because again, it's so hard for us to believe on those of us spend too much time on the internal LLP stuff. But outside of those circles, it's on a local level, it's an advantage of anything.
I have a quick follow up, and then if Brandy or Amy has a question. But have you ever, when explaining your vote or trying to persuade somebody, like have you ever gotten like surprise or pushback for like voting on principle? Like do they talk about principle, or is it just like very pragmatic to them? And I would imagine it's probably different in a lot of different settings. But again, from my experience covering it, I never really heard anybody make any sort of ideological or moral arguments in a city council meeting. So, do you ever, introduce those types of talking about issues, and what kind of response do you get?
I haven't had a ton of that. You know, like James, a lot of things are close to unanimous, which, you know, it sort of goes both ways. In some sense, it's a shame. In some sense, it probably shows that people are using their brains. I definitely get some eye rolls, you know, when I'm the one no vote against something, but nothing too bad. I mean, ultimately, as long as you're not, you know, trying to making, you know, moral arguments towards things is great, but I think it's when people introduce emotional arguments and make accusations and appeals to emotion and stuff, I think people get really turned off by. So certainly the times that I've done it, I'm not going to say I've gotten full buy-in. Oh yes, now I agree. Taxation is theft. But I think people understand where I'm coming from, and they understand, and almost more important than that, they understand that I'm coming at it from a place that I do care about the city. I do care about the city functioning well. It's not that I am doing this to be obstructive. I'm doing it because I really believe in it. It comes from a place of sincerity.
Okay. James?
Yeah. So as Bill kind of mentioned, there's not a lot of opportunity for philosophical arguments. But, you know, personally, if I see an opportunity to talk about a little bit of philosophy, I try to interject that as to why. Like during the discussion, you know, period of like a vote or something like that, or during an issue like in a workshop. Something comes to mind. I think this kind of illustrates what we're talking about. There's always this initial kind of knee-jerk reaction of members of the community to look to the local government or the state government or federal government, whoever it is, to solve the problem or something that they don't like. They say, hey, I don't like this, fix it, right? And that's a knee-jerk reaction. I don't think it's very intentional, but I think that's just the way that everyone's kind of programmed to be. I think the way that school is taught kind of teaches that from a very, very young age. These are the authorities. They make all the rules. So when you get older and you have a problem, you just go to the guys that make the rules, right? And I think that's detrimental in a lot of ways. Just as a side note, I have mini pigs and they're talking in the background. So that's what it is.
when you finish your point, you might as well just introduce us to one of them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So there was an example of a sign in somebody's front yard that was very derogatory to our current president, and it used some profanity, like some actual profanity. It wasn't bleeped out or anything like that. And, there was a lot of people that were probably fans of the current president and were very frustrated by it and wanted to have the local government take it down or punish or fine the person right in their yard. And, it kind of went around. You know, we were talking about it. I like to let people speak first before I kind of interject and kind of, you know, guide a conversation. And, you know, there's some people in the public that were saying, we should have an ordinance against signs. You should have to have a permit to have a sign in your yard. We should fine him. We should send the police to go talk to him. All these things. Everything was, in the back of my mind, I'm like, all of this is predicated upon some kind of force or threat of force. And I am just naturally averse to that kind of thing. And so in the middle of this conversation, I'm like, has anybody, talked to this guy? And has anybody just said, hey, it's not great for kids to see profanity, just not from a government standpoint, but just as a neighbor, and that was I kind of led that discussion, that thought process to say, our first reaction is to use, government, which is kind of like a cold. I can send a letter. It's kind of how I said it. It's like, I can send a letter. We can send the police, but you know, let's, why not just try asking first? This has happened multiple times. And this, you know, the first one happened a couple of years ago, but there was one that was pretty recent. And the beautiful thing was, after the meeting, I just went and talked to the gentleman. I said, hey, you know, some people are a little frustrated by it. Like I totally get it. You know, I even offered to buy him a sign that didn't have profanity in it, you know, that kind of thing. And he was very, very receptive to it. And so we took it down and, you know, there's still a anti-Biden sign, but it's much less profane and it seems to be a happy medium. But I just think it kind of illustrates how everyone's first inclination is to use some kind of force instead of just expressing how they feel to their neighbors and not even using me as a medium, but just going and talking to your neighbors. I think, unfortunately, that art is kind of lost. But I think I try to talk on philosophy, you know, like during the conversation, I'm like, well, I mean, it is on their private property and they have a right to say what they want, but there's no reason why you can't ask nicely. You know, that was kind of the spin I try to put on the conversation. So just in a nutshell, that kind of is my approach on a lot of things.
James, show us the pigs.
I know, that's what I was waiting for. Let's see what we got here.
No, I gotta have a follow up after James shows us the pigs.
Go ahead.
We need to let James answer.
Come here, baby.
Oh, here we go.
Come here, honey. Fiona, come here, girl. Come here.
What a cutie.
Come say hi, baby.
Oh my gosh.
I'm gonna see if
Fiona.
I can.
Fiona.
This is Fiona. You wanna say hi, honey? There she is.
That's funny.
Aaron, is this your best Tallulah. Guest yet?
Let's see. Here's Tallulah. She's laying down here.
Whenever I'm working here in my little home office, they always lay next to me so I can pet them.
That's funny.
But yeah, are they litter box trained?
Oh, absolutely. they've never had an accident in the house. They're wonderful pets. They're very sweet.
Wow.
Okay, so they are pets and not just livestock who are too young to be out in the barn.
That's correct.
Okay.
That is correct.
Okay, I wasn't sure. If you...
Go ahead.
On your point on the FJB signs, like if you were mayor here in Knox County, like Glenn Jacobs is, and you tried to talk to people to get them to take those signs down, it would be a full time job in the north side of Knox County. But like literally every block. Anyway, Bill, you were going to say something on that.
Yeah, we need to let James answer first because immediately when he started talking, I realized I have great examples of what you asked about, Aaron, even though I told you no before. and part of it was James reminded me. Two things come to mind where I have waxed a little bit of moral arguments. Number one was an HOA in our city. It's like still in development, so they control their boards for until they're done with construction for 30 plus more years. They don't allow solar panels. And two of our councilmen showed up and said, "Oh, like the HOA bylaws say that if a city council doesn't allow us to do this, we'll of course allow solar panels." And but I, you know, I said, "Look, I think it's a ridiculous bylaw. People put up solar panels on their properties. Go ahead." But like, we're not injecting government into what's ultimately a contract between a resident and a developer. I said, "But I personally will go talk to this developer. I'm happy to do it." And then the other one where I've really injected some of the ideology, the moral arguments, hasn't been as much in the large council meetings, but I'm on our zoning committee, and our zoning committee is going through a huge overhaul. And I had an opportunity, and this was towards the beginning of my time there. I said, "Look, I'm not going to do this every meeting we have. I'm not going to go into the moral philosophy behind it." But exactly what James said, I said, "Look, you can think of these regulations and rules as nonviolence, but ultimately you draw it out to its conclusion. You know, it is at the barrel of a gun." And they said, no, it's not criminal, it's civil. And I said, okay, so this goes down in civil court, the resident loses, and he still says no, who do you send? You know, the police. And some of the other committee members have definitely been slashing a lot more regulations that were not necessary after that. And even our city administrator, who is a retired police officer and now runs the city from a staffing standpoint, he was like, we were talking, he goes, I've learned a lot already. It's a really different perspective on things. And so, yeah, you have to pick your spots, of course, but when appropriate, I've been able to do it. And it's been really well received.
Amy, I know that you're going to leave us a little earlier before we wrap up tonight. So I want to give you a chance to ask a question, maybe from your vantage point as someone who helps prospective candidates. Just what you've heard from James and Bill tonight, what do you want to learn from them, or what do you think that are candidates who haven't won yet might benefit from?
Yeah, I think if there are, you know, if there are candidates who are watching, the example of Bill and James, as I said before, are incredible ones. They are articulate, they are professional, they wield influence, they're engaged in their communities. And so if they learn nothing else from what we try to invest, kind of the way we invest time and financial contribution and resources into our candidates, the reason we do that is because our expectation of them is they will be just as Bill and James are now, right? Wielding influence, compassionate, engaged, listening in their community, talking about philosophy when it is time and when it is appropriate, right? Not starting an end the Fed chant in the middle of the city council meeting necessarily, but explaining our principles and why we believe what we believe and why we act and why their actions flow naturally from their principles when it is appropriate. So I think our candidates have that sense already. You know, we vet our candidates pretty closely, and we endorse candidates who will follow kind of in the footsteps of James and Bill, and people like Aaron Lamb, mayor of Kingsburg, Colorado, and Kelly Cardin, who we all spoke with a little bit earlier from Rosamond, California, and so many others. And I'll just also stop here and say very briefly, for people who wonder what the Mises Caucus is doing right now, we are putting rock stars like Bill and James in towns where they are working. You know, what James described, making sure that we are not acting on someone who has an inappropriate sign in their yard with force, and instead of community and community values, that's magic. It might seem like it is not a big deal to someone with an untrained ear, right? Someone who is not listening for people who are making incredible change in not only how we pass ordinance in communities, but also the values and philosophy of our communities. When we insert people like James, like Bill, like Kelly, like Aaron, it is a game changer. And so they are working magic. So if you're wondering what the Mises Caucus is up to, we have nine candidates nine elected officials right now, just since we kind of kicked off this effort. And we'll have a whole lot more. I think November is going to look pretty good. We're going to have some wins. But I do have a question for James and for Bill. And then I have a hard stop at 8:30. So in the news, we are hearing that the preparations for another round of COVID lockdowns and mask mandates are afoot, and it's probably something we can all expect to see this fall. What kinds of conversations are occurring at the level of your municipality in terms of preparedness and how because you are libertarians, you know, what your actions and votes might look like around those items? James, do you want to get started?
Yeah, so I was on council during the first round, and it was mid 2021, so it was kind of after a lot of the stuff had been solidified in a way, and you know, at first I was a little unsure how to speak up and kind of fight the inertia a little bit, but you know, probably by the end of 21, we started doing things because in my mind, you know, I want to, you know, not use force, but also try to accommodate as many people, because I'm not going to judge somebody that is scared of something. I think that's something to be, you know, understanding about. So like just a minor example of one of the things we did, and just kind of stemming from that, the type of things that we talk about and how we kind of approach the issue. I like to get people to the meetings. We had one side of the room with chairs that were normally spaced out, and the other side were, you know, half as dense, so that people were concerned and didn't want to be around people could go sit on this side, and people that didn't care could go sit on this side, and just, you know, try to be accommodating without letting it overly control the conversations that we're having about the community, right? So trying to facilitate being non-judgmental, but also not overreacting one way or another on that kind of policy. And also, you know, some of the conversations we've had, we're not going to shut down any events. I think in 2020, they had shut down just about every single event, including fireworks. And we've already had conversations. We're just not going to even really discuss that type of approach. You know, I think the last discussion that we had prior to becoming mayor, but I was still on council, was, you know, do we really want to allow, you know, what's our threshold for allowing events and that kind of thing. And, you know, I just made the statement. I was like, look, it's not really the town's event. Usually they're hosted by private organizations. I trust private organizations will have the restrictions that they feel are necessary. And then the people that feel that those restrictions or lack of restrictions accommodate them, they're going to be the people that kind of patronize that event. And if people are concerned that there's not enough restrictions, well, then they probably won't go. And I don't really want to get involved in a business or an organization, you know, putting on an event, because I assume the people that want to go are going to go, and the people that don't want to go are not going to go, and just kind of left it at that. And that's kind of been the approach so far, is I just don't, we're not going to get involved one way or another with that kind of restriction, to kind of leave it up to the people that want to participate.
Yeah, what I say is we haven't had many conversations about the renewal of these mandates and all that coming back. What I would say is that I have shared with the other council members and the mayor that was a motivation for me getting involved. And, you know, I alluded to earlier, there have been certain topics where, you know, I'm not going to say that I compromised my principles, but perhaps, you know, something that I was opposed to that I knew everybody wanted to pass, and I knew I could go on for 10 minutes about why I was wrong, I would just say, hey, you know what, I'm going to register my no vote, and I'm not going to bore you guys with some discussion. COVID, the bringing back of the COVID regime will not be one of those things. I don't know if it's the filibuster per se, but I will be going on and on about why it's not appropriate. It's easier for me to say I live again in Thomas Massie country. So it's not like there's a huge set of enthusiasm for the renewal of these sort of things. But I'm confident that this will be somewhere where I will stand my ground. Can I, before Amy leaves, brag about her and the Mises Caucus and the support for a few minutes?
I was going to ask you guys to do that. Yeah. And if you had any suggestions.
We got to do it while she's still on air so that we can see her blush ahead. And all that, you know? I was going to say, I actually hired Amy's company for some work for my own company. I had heard her advertisement on a different podcast, the Mises Caucus-ish podcast, and just got to know her through that. And you know, Amy knew that I, again, yeah, like she said, was involved in my community, had some influence in my community and all that. And I even, at one point there was an interim spot I told her about. Amy not once pressured me into running. Oh, you got to do this. Oh, you need, like, totally let me go at my own pace. And then when I said, okay, I am running, Amy was always there to help where I needed, not push too much, but it's good. You know, when you're running for office and you don't know what you're doing, it's your first time. And, you know, she would poke me every 4 weeks. Hey, how can I help? And one thing I eventually needed help with was some graphic design for a flyer. And Amy stepped up. She found me somebody highly competent to do it. And I think that's a huge part of why I was able to, you know, not only become elected, but also be the highest vote getter in my race. So kudos to Amy. Kudos to the Run as Libertarian team, the Mises Caucus. It was hugely helpful and supportive of me at exactly the right pace. Not too much push, not too much pull. So the caucus has a good one there in Amy.
I agree.
Bill, mostly that is kudos to the nearly, since you ran, it has grown, but the nearly 50 volunteers across the country who step in anytime we have a candidate who has a task that needs to be carried out. They're doing incredible work. But thank you.
Yeah. And for anybody out there, if you get elected, you get presumably you get invited to our highly, highly selected private group chat for elected Mises Caucus Libertarians. Which is a great sounding board of people to bounce ideas off and have discussions.
Yeah, hopefully that'll get bigger and bigger, hopefully over the next few months here.
Yeah, Amy's been nothing but wonderful. We actually poached her to Maryland from Delaware. So just got to say, we kind of won on that trade.
Yeah. All right, Amy. Thanks for coming on. And I do want to thank you for getting that volunteer team together, because that's something that I was involved with the Libertarian Party in Ohio for a while, and our candidates had need of those things all the time, and it was always like, okay, you know, scrambling to find help for people. And so that we basically, Amy's built up a roster of people who can volunteer to do those things, things like text banking, phone banking, different things. So if you are a candidate already and haven't signed up to run as Libertarian and need some of that support, or maybe you are already in the mix and didn't know that we have those things now, just let us know and we'll connect you with somebody as best we can. So Amy, I appreciate you coming on. And I know that like you and I, when we have our Mises Caucus executive board meetings, you and I are the ones who always don't want to do them at night. So I appreciate you hanging out in the evening, and we'll have you back on again sometime. Okay.
It is wonderful to see James and Bill and Brandon and Aaron. You guys are doing a phenomenal job with the podcast. So thank you for having me.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We'll see you, Amy.
Good night.
Okay.
I think the first meeting I ever had with Amy, she sent me that Calendly to give her availability. And I opened it up, and like the first call time was 5:40 a.m. And I texted her. I was like, that's surely an error, right? She's like, if you do it, I'll do it. So I think we had our first call at 5:40 a.m. Yeah, she's a hard worker.
Yeah. Brady, I got a couple of questions, but what's on your mind before I jump into mine?
So one question I have for both of you is, how important do you think social media is when you're running a campaign at the local level? Or do you think that it's more important for you to be, you know, on the ground talking to people within your community? Do you think it's kind of like a mix, like you kind of need both? Like, how much precedent do you think social media actually takes when it comes to running a campaign?
Personally, I would say at the local level, it's going to be more on the ground.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the people that vote in local elections, especially in off cycle years, are not social media consumers. But I think that successes that you have as an elected local politician can be used on social media and shared and shine a tremendous light on your party, which is hugely impactful, of course, for state and federal races. So, yeah, I think, you know, if somebody out there is not social media savvy, I would not be intimidated by that in terms of running for local office. I tend to use social media as just a place to vent more than anything. But it's hard to say. I mean, again, I certainly had a more active social media presence, and part of that was just my local LP affiliate being out there than anybody else did that was running in my race. And I again got the most votes, so it may have had more of an effect than I recognize right now.
What about you, James?
I'll say that even on a local level, I think social media is very important to have. You know, they're like just being a part of local community groups and kind of hearing some of the things that are going on, some of the conversations that are going on, can help kind of channel some of the conversations you have with people in real life. You know, I will say, though, that I do attribute a lot of the success that I had, you know, both in my council run and mayoral run, on the ability to literally knock on every door and to really talk to people. And I think if that makes that probably puts everything over the edge, being able to shake people's hands. They've seen your face. They know who you are. You know, you seem genuine and that kind of thing. I think that kind of puts it over the top, but also just being active in community groups and hearing what the community has to say, just kind of being there as maybe an interjector of ideas as well. And I think they're both very important. I used social media pretty heavily, but I also just door knocked. So I would honestly say it's probably, you know, like a 60-40 split on, you know, in-person door knocking versus social media stuff. So
like 60% would be door knocking and 40% would be social media.
I would say
so can you contribute more, your win more so to being like on the ground and that? Right.
I do. Yeah.
That makes sense. I think,
Brandy, there's probably a difference between the city level and the county level, you know, like at the city level and like James alluded to, it's possible to go knock on every door. Even when you get to the county, which is obviously still clearly a local race, that's not going to be possible at most counties. And so social media can become more important even at just that level, let alone, of course, state and federal.
Yeah. Even a state like Kentucky, who has like incredibly small counties geographically wise, there's like 111 counties in Kentucky, which is all my people are from Eastern Kentucky. So
third most in the country, because and the reason why is when they designed the county system, they wanted every resident of the state to be within one day's horse ride of the of the county courthouse. So
yeah,
they and a lot of the, and it's
a lot it, go, no go ahead
a lot of duplication of efforts, a lot of duplication of services. It's an interesting thing. Yeah.
I had a, my dad's cousin was jailer of a county in Eastern Kentucky. They have, some of those counties have, like constable and jailer and these weird little offices and stuff. And a lot of those towns have the county courthouse is like always in the middle of the county, and it's like a nice little, it's, yeah, it's a lot of those little towns are great over there. Talking about knocking doors and stuff like that, what's the most common, you know, two or three questions that you get when, cause like for me, like, I don't mind like public speaking and stuff like that, but like the thought of like knocking on a stranger's door and saying, vote for me, just like terrifies me. I would not be able to do that. So, those of you who have the courage to do that and, or, you know, wherever you're out talking to people and you say, hey, I'm running for something, what questions, are the most common?
So I'll say, so my community is fairly rural. It's kind of funny. There's a lot of people, everybody kind of knows everybody. I'll say one of the most, common questions that I got is, you know, who are your parents? Which is kind of funny because people want to know where you came from. Are you one of us? Are you part of our community? Do I know your parents? Right. So even though that's not really a political question, it was kind of one of the questions that I got asked pretty often. But I mean, aside from that, I mean, there's specific issues that, you know, my community's dealt with, but like on a grander scale, it's more dealing with the economy. So there's a big differential between, you know, older people in my community. There's like almost 65% people over 55. And so there's a very, very small group of young people. And they're like, how do you flip that? What are your ideas on that? How do you kind of jumpstart the economy? How do you encourage businesses? How do you kind of revitalize our industry? That kind of thing. So it was really economically driven. And then really just wanting to know that you're, you know, you are one of them. You feel the things that they feel. And I think that was pretty much it. It wasn't anything specific and nothing really federal. And there was a handful of people that just wanted to talk federal politics, which is fun, you know, but on a local level is, hey, you know, my groceries are expensive. And, you know, what are you going to do to help create jobs locally? It's some pretty basic stuff. And I think that's one of the cool things on the local level is people really are just worried about, they want to take care of their families. They want to be able to eat. They want to be able to relax a little bit, and they want to be safe. And, you know, it's really basic. And so those are the kind of questions that you get.
Yep. Totally agree. Got a bunch of questions about, oh, is Mark Schulte your brother? I was like, that's my younger brother. You're supposed to know me more than him. Very insulting. But, I would say, some of that also, I mean, you know, keep in mind for any potential candidates out there, it's not, you're not going to knock. Maybe you did, James. I didn't knock on every single door myself. I had other members of our county affiliate and the neighboring counties come, and we did a 2 big door knocking days where we kind of covered it all together. So a lot of that times they were talking on my behalf, and I gave them some, you know, some talking points for big relevant items in the city. I know it's the libertarian boogeyman, but the roads are the big deal here. The road maintenance, the access road, the new neighborhood road, all that. The other thing that I did that worked out really well, and I'll have to be honest, it was partially out of laziness. But when I went to Amy, I said, "Hey, I need a flyer designed for me." She kind of shoehorned a flyer from some other campaign, a libertarian campaign in Pennsylvania, for a much more rural area. And there were 5 bullet points, and I replaced 4 of them. And the one I did not replace was about food freedom. I was like, you know what? I'm going to leave it here. We're not really a farming community. But it's a great topic to highlight a unique issue. Thomas Massey obviously does the Prime X. Some people know that. And it made an interesting talking point. People look at it, they looked at my list, and it had the, you know, for transparency, against spending and taxation, food, you know, food freedom, what's that? And it gave me a sounding board to get into a topic they never heard of, you know, to be able to tell them, hey, did you know it's illegal for that farm down the road or one county over? It's illegal for them to directly sell meat to you. Instead, they have to go through a federally licensed processor, which adds so much time, you know, in terms of farm to table and money and all that into the process. So I think you can, you know, to pigeonhole people into unique issues, not pigeonhole, to direct people into unique issues, you know, think about something a little off the wall, something that's not going to be a super heated topic that everybody has a super strong opinion one way or the other on. Most people would agree is federal and state overreach. Put that on there, put it on a piece of paper and give it a chance to talk about that. And if nothing else, it might give you an opportunity to get some philosophy into the discussion instead of just, you know, nuts and bolts day-to-day stuff.
Do you guys have a lot of people asking you what a libertarian is? I feel like I do, like, just in general, like, my life. Like, if I say I'm a libertarian, like, I just spend a lot of time explaining that. Was there a lot of that as well? where people were like, what are you, a Democrat or a Republican? And you're like, neither. Right.
Yeah. Like I said, for me, I always, it's so important for me when running for office to let to do this for the LP, to let them know about the LP.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think the problem you run into there is like, you have two kinds of people. Like you have one who already have some usually wrong notion in their head of what a libertarian is. And then you have other people that like have no idea and also are too afraid to even ask, or they just mistake it for liberal or something.
Yeah.
But it's, but I do every opportunity I can, like I said, with that food freedom to say, you know, this is the kind of stuff libertarians actually think about and care about. It's not just figuring out how we're going to spend your money. It's figuring out how do we keep the government out of your lives.
Yeah. One of the early topics that came up, I think James said something he was surprised at how much that local governments are constrained by, you know, the, you know, how their charters are written or however in the state of, and Bill mentioned something about, oh, you know, you got to keep our, you know, our tax projections at a certain level. And so there is a lot of, you know, top-down stuff that you guys are not able to change, which leads into, you know, as the Mises Caucus, like one of the key things along with, you know, local candidates is to start finding ways where we could do things like nullification or, you know, anything to sort of find, you know, get pockets of freedom here and there, whether through like a citizen initiative or, you know, the issues coalitions, and specifically around, hey, that's a law, but we're not going to follow it in this. Our government is not going to enforce that. So things like Second Amendment sanctuaries, drug legalization, things like that, that have happened at the municipal or county level across the United States. And I realize that, you know, some of those, that might be, if you came at it from a very doctrinaire, oh, we're, you know, screw the feds, we're gonna do this, that might not be the best way to put things over on the ground. But are there areas where you think that things like nullification or, you know, nullification adjacent type things could, you could awaken some of that in some of your colleagues?
Yeah, I think so. I think especially if the COVID mandates begin to come back, we're going to do a lot of that. You know, I'm conflicted about nullification, not the topic itself. I love the topic, but in terms of putting it in a local level. As a matter of fact, what I'm focusing on before that, and this was, I think was a Justin Amash suggestion, is, and I actually told the other council members last month that I will in September show up to our next council meeting with a list, is I'm going to read every single law we have in our city and we're going to repeal the bad ones, which is different than nullification, of course, but I think we'll get the philosophy across of you know, hey, we do not need some of these laws. And by extension, when new bad federal laws come out, we'll be able to make that difference. And I would say too, like it varies state by state. You know this, Aaron, probably from your Ohio days, but in Ohio, my understanding is that that misdemeanors are actually handled like at the county level or maybe even city level, city level, if I remember correctly, yeah. Like by a magistrate. And so as a result of that, they're able to do de facto marijuana decriminalization city by city, because can you in your city put a law on the books that says marijuana is legal? No, but you can reduce fines and court costs to zero, which the cops are not going to bother chasing it down if there's no way to make money. So, Kentucky, unfortunately, we have a unified court system, so I can't do that much at the city level. It would have to be at the county, but you know, there are opportunities to make substantial differences at the local level. Especially in some states more than others.
James.
Yeah, I'm going to echo a lot of what Bill said. I mean, on the local level, I'll be honest, I haven't focused very much on nullification at all, because there's enough on our books that is just needs to be dealt with, and inviting that onto, you know, a community that may need to use its police force to enforce or not enforce something. It's challenging. It's challenging. I feel like in certain things that it's, you know, you got to fix the things that are in your jurisdiction and get that kind of thing taken care of before you can kind of look above you. Now, if something is, you know, forced on the community, like, for example, and this kind of goes into why it's good to have good relationships with people that are, let's say, higher up on the food chain than you. Maryland is kind of pushing through something called Kerwin, which is a blueprint for education. And it's extremely costly, and it disproportionately affects small counties and poor counties, and disproportionately helps like Baltimore City and some of the richer counties in the state. And so just having a good relationship with my county commissioners and saying, why don't you just say no, that you're not going to do it, because they have a lot more control over education than I do. But this would be something that directly impacts my community, and we shouldn't be doing it. Right. So there's very little that comes in. I think it's easier to resist something as it's being implemented than to retroactively say we're not going to do this. So as things come down, you can say, hey, no, we don't want to do that. And then kind of start that conversation with, like I said, at the county level. And they're very, very open to literally saying no. And, you know, building a coalition of other counties around the state to also say no, which I think is pretty cool. So watching that unfold from a local level, hey, Commissioner, this is impacting my community. This is going to really hit us. We are actually actively being negatively impacted by this, and it's not sustainable. And then encouraging them to kind of do what they should do and say no. So that kind of thing to me is where I see nullification in a way. But, you know, honestly, I'm you know, it's silly, but like last meeting, our town code says that you need to have a fence around any pool. And the discussion was, well, what about kiddie pools, like the little inflatable ones? I'm like, no, that's ridiculous. Like that kind of thing. So we're just going to get rid of that. You know, that kind of thing to me is almost the nullification on the local level. Like, hey, this is silly. When a silly law comes up, we just get rid of it. Either, you know, and I always say either you enforce it or you get rid of it and be prepared to enforce it. Are you prepared to enforce that kind of thing? I'm not, because it's not a big deal.
Yeah. Let me add this. So the thing about nullification, too, especially federal nullification, which is really the main one, is it's very scalable. Like James is right. We both have a lot on our plates dealing with the day to day and ins and outs of the cities. But, you know, and I've told, I think, Amy and maybe Michael or Angelus before, like, send it to me. Send me the language. You know, it doesn't need to be me in Crescent Springs drafting federal nullification. I know what form to put it in, but, you know, I don't have the time to type it up and do that. Like, I would welcome, and I think a lot of other elected officials, probably across the entire Libertarian Party, would welcome, you know, a mass. Hey, here's language to nullify whatever it is, gun laws, you know, and I'd be happy to enact it that way. But, you know, my plate's full with trying to, again, keep the tax rate from being increased and wasteful spending and all that. But I think it's a great topic for, you know, somebody out there who's not elected or in a more national facing role to feed that stuff to us elected officials. I'd be happy to try to implement that in my city.
We have some of that stuff. Mainly, I think we got about 98% of it from the 10th Amendment Center. They do have a lot of sort of template legislation on different things that is available from them. And it's up on our website somewhere. And I know we're changing our website around. So I don't know where it is off the top of my head. But Amy and that candidate support team could get that to you. And if not, if we don't have something exactly like it, we could modify it. So you guys who are guests on the podcast, but also people maybe listening to this, just reach out to us at the Mises Caucus or the 10th Amendment Center. And between the two of us, we probably have something. And if we don't, that would be something that we could then help. You know, if one person has the idea, then we can, you know, tag team it and get it out to everybody. But that's exactly the type of stuff that candidate support team can do. And I think that both of you kind of made this point that I've always been a big believer in trying to appeal to incumbent politicians, whatever their ideology, not in terms of like, oh, did you know what Thomas Jefferson said about this in 1798, you know, Kentucky resolutions, but hey, you're trying to do a job here in this county, and the state or the federal government is trying to make this hard for you. Why are you going to take that, right? To try to appeal to their common sense, practical needs. And like, they may not see it as an ideological thing, but, you know, in the business world or something like that, if someone is, you know, making, you know, trying to get you or your company to do something you don't want to do in a negotiation, then you kind of stand up to them and you talk it out and things like that. And I think that that's one tack that we should take, is not trying to convince, either Gavin Newsom or, somebody who's the mayor of your town, Bill, to buy it ideologically, but basically it's like, oh, what, are you going to take that? Why don't we talk to them and tell them how hard it's going to be for us to enforce it until they make it easier on us? We're not going to do it. So, I think that, has a chance to work. And I think it was James that said it's easier when those things are, being proposed to come down this way, to start planning that in people's minds then, of like, hey, yeah, it's just not going to work here in our town or our county. So, let's just not lay down and take it. So, do you guys have, any other questions or feedback for the Mises Caucus, or, just anything else on your minds? Before we go, I kind of have one question to kind of go out on, but, anybody has something else you want to talk about before we go, Brandy, you have anything?
No,
that wasn't
no?
Brandy. That was Fiona. I'll just ask, each of you to, just give advice to somebody who may be on the fence as to whether or not they want to run or as a candidate or, become a campaign manager at the local level, give them your pitch, to why they should, consider it and why they should, try to do that, with the help of the Mises Caucus. James, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I my personal experience is that it's been extremely fulfilling. Feeling like you can actually make an impact to help your local community is kind of wonderful. And then actually being able to follow through with that is fantastic. And then realizing that, you may be, the single voice or the single, vote that kind of changes the tide in one thing or another, it's kind of important that people that value, personal property and freedom and monetary, economic development and those types of things. It's important to have people in that gap. And, if not you, then who? It's probably going to be somebody that's not as conscious as you. So even if, I often feel imposter syndrome in a lot of different ways. Like I look at all the things that I'm doing, I'm like, what am I doing? I'm not qualified for any of this really. But, that's kind of most politicians and, especially at the local level, they're just regular people that really just want to try to help. And if you can try to help in a more freedom oriented way, then I think you should consider it. And even if you don't want to be, this is the other thing that I think is important. You don't have to necessarily, if you want to get involved and help, you don't necessarily have to run in an election. Start coming to council meetings or commissioner meetings or something like that. Have conversations during the public comment period, get to know each one because they're just regular people too. Talk to them, influence them. And then maybe, offer to be on a board. Like planning and zoning is huge, right? So if you build a reputation and a rapport with mayor and council, and then there's a vacancy on the zoning board, throw your name in, throw your hat in the ring. Because it's really, I don't think people realize how much impact like a planning and zoning board has, or really any board, whether it's communications or ethics or something like that. You can really make a lot of impact, kind of learn the ins and outs of local government or even higher, and make some connections. And then maybe then, once your feet are wet, you'll have a little bit more confidence and have some things to speak from, based on your experience. So I would just encourage at the very least, get involved, the next level, maybe offer to be on a board, learn a little bit about how it works. And then, if you're still feeling up to it, dive in. Cause I think the world needs a lot of people that are willing to take that step. There's not a lot that are willing to do that. So I would just really encourage get involved one way or another.
Yeah. What I would say, for those that are on the fence about reaching out to the team at runaslibertarian.com, do not feel like if you reach out, you're going to constantly be pressured to run. It is truly a exploratory conversation. The Mises Caucus team, they're not going to pressure you into doing it. And then in terms of people deciding whether or not to run, if they're on the fence, You know, I would say, like, I can assure you it will not be a waste of your time. And there are many different things you can do in terms of your liberty activism and support of liberty and all that, even donations that might just be totally a waste. And you feel like, what was the point of this? But, you know, running for office, even if you were to not win, is not a waste of time. Whether I've made so many connections, even outside of my city, in my county, in my area, people now reach out to me for things. Hey, can you help with this? Hey, do you know with this? What are your thoughts here? That I can say it's certainly been an opportunity to make an impact. And I'll finish my remarks with the quote from Plato that James just reminded me of. Those who are too smart to engage in politics are punished by being governed by those who are dumber. So Plato knew it however many, 2,500, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and it's totally true. So if you're on the fence, you'll regret it if you don't.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Whenever I would cover city council or especially school board meetings, I'm just like, I can't believe these people have with these opinions have the ability to make people do things. And I think you guys are proving that it does in a lot of cases, just showing up. You know, I say we're governed by people who think it's fun to go to a city council meeting, right? Like, and so even though it may not be fun for us, if we go into it with the goal of doing something good for our neighbors, that we might be able to break some of that. So I really appreciate guys like you who are willing to do things that a lot of us, you know, temperamentally or otherwise aren't inclined to do. So, yeah, Brandy, do you have just want to say goodbye or anything before we let them get back to their lives? And, you know, in James's case, tending the pigs.
No, but I just want to thank you guys. Thanks for actually getting involved and running, because I, like was said before, there's a lot of people that aren't willing to do that. I've thought about the idea many times, and I always get like, I scare myself out of it every time. So
well, I would have considered myself an unwilling to do it person until one day I just decided to take the plunge, and I'm glad I did in retrospect.
Maybe someday I will. Okay. Maybe.
All right, guys. Mike is working on our guest for next week, so we should be back this time next week, 7:30 Eastern. James, Bill, I really appreciate your help tonight and just, you know, doing what you're doing. And please let us know if things come up in the future that that we need to know about, or that in ways that we can help you, we'll do everything we can. Okay.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Yep. If we can help, let us know. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. Bye, guys. We'll see you.